when it's shared. I feel my life is so much better now that I get to share it with you. Lana, today, in the presence of God and our closest family and friends, I want to tell you that I will forever be your one and only. I promise to be your clown when you need laughter. I promise to be your map when you need guidance. I promise never to make fun of Oprah. I will be your muse when you're searching for inspiration. I promise to be more accepting of people. And I promise to leave the thermostat at 72 degrees. Lana, I find something about you every day that makes me fall more madly in love with you. You have shown me what love feels like, and for that, I'm forever grateful. My heart will be your shelter, and my arms will be your home. I love you, little one, and I can't wait to share the rest of my life with you. I read them as best as I could while trying not to sob. Lana went next. She kept a straight face when she delivered hers. She's much more in control of her emotions than I am. I happen to think it's because she's been through the worst of life with her father's sudden death when she was 17. Happy moments don't make her cry. She smiled, reading hers. She made some of the same jokes about the thermostat and our different taste in TV shows, and to remain calm when you wander off in the grocery store. But in the end, all that matters to me was her final line. I'm so lucky to be on this journey with you while loving, learning, and walking together forever. I love you today and always. The reception was jaw-dropping and started with a moment of drama and grace before anyone could even have a chance to catch their breath from the ceremony. We'd hired ballerinas from a nearby ballet school to stand with big white balloons on strings amongst the cypress trees during the ceremony. And then they looped around to the reception area and took each balloon, with numbers on them, to the corresponding table to help people find their seats. The band was outstanding. When they did a Beyoncé song, it sounded so perfect, I thought Bey herself was doing a guest spot. During our first dance, Try Me by James Brown, Lana paused, unhooked something, and stepped out of the long, fluffy part of her dress, revealing the top turned into a mini dress that was underneath for dancing. I had no idea the puffy part even came off. The creative surprises at this wedding just didn't quit. My parents and in-laws made toasts during the dinner. Again, my father fell flat. He said, "Let the good times roll." That was his toast. He's Mr. Personality at the salon, but once he gets in front of a large group, forget it. The food was incredible. Not that I remember eating a single bite of it. The reception went by in a blur. There was so much going on with the dancing and eating and drinking and talking to people and hosting. I remember this day of the entire weekend the least. I know I was overjoyed to be married, to share this experience with guests, and that Lana's parents were paying for it. My parents did contribute too. When the ballerinas appeared, Dad joked, "Did I pay for the dancers?" The final event of the weekend was the Sunday brunch. My wife wanted to incorporate art into each event, so we set up a graffiti wall where people added their own painting and drawing on an overall wedding theme, the art of love. Our wedding was the greatest weekend of my life so far, by far. I'd never been part of a huge production like that. The focus of so many people's brilliance and creativity. I was literally blown away. Our marriage has turned out to be a lot like our wedding, full of surprises and dramatic moments, popping with brilliance and beauty and laughter all the way through. Chapter 7. Sous Chef. I have always taken pride in my style and thought of myself as a sharp dresser. By the way, Lana hates the word sharp. She never used it growing up. I never found it strange until she told me it was. And then I asked around and others agree. I don't know if it's an Italian thing, generational, or Midwest speak, but whatever it is, I used it sparingly around her so I didn't frost her bananas. So the word sharp is out. Soon after Lana and I moved in together, I lost my confidence in my sharp dressing, too. I came home one day to find her and her friend Nazi in my closet, organizing and making a giveaway pile of some of my best clothes. Some of the most fashionable women I knew were trashing my wardrobe. My collection of Adidas tracksuits in every bright color? Gone. My Western plaid button-downs with eagle embroidered on the front pocket? Trashed. They even put my jupe cologne in the pile. I've been looking for it for 6 months. Where'd you find this? I'd asked, holding up the purple bottle. Lana confessed, I hid it a while ago. You don't like jupe? It's been my signature scent for years. Don't take it personally, she said, but it gives me a headache and a stomach ache and hives. I gave it one last sniff and retired it into the cologne graveyard. I appreciated the brutal honesty, but the giveaway pile amounted to thousands of dollars worth of clothes, not to mention the memories. Lana operated on a much higher taste level than I did. As an artist, her job was to have a sophisticated aesthetic. If she hated this stuff, I probably should get rid of it all. My trust in my own fashion sense was completely rocked, and I turned over control of my look, head to toe, hair to shoes, to her. In fact, Lana was put in charge of all style-related purchases for us, including all of our clothes and home decor. I was relegated to handling the logistics, finances, electronics, travel, etc. This arrangement has worked well for us, and my style has improved exponentially. You could actually watch my 4 comedy specials to chart how my style has evolved and improved over the last 10 years. Sebastian Live was filmed at the Pageant Theater in St. Louis in 2007, but it got underway a couple of years before that. While I was on the Wild West Comedy Tour, we stopped in St. Louis for a gig. After the show, the other guys and I were hanging out at the bar, and a man came up to me and said, "What are you doing here?" It took a second, but I placed him as a longtime customer of mine at the Four Seasons in L.A. I remembered him because he was a great tipper. He just seen the show, and he was pleasantly surprised to find me in it. We got to talking, and he told me he worked for Budweiser, which just happened to be one of the tour's sponsors. He was actually involved in the sponsorship program at the company, and he'd been sent to St. Louis to check out the tour. It was all such a small world coincidence. We were both just shaking our heads. You know, Budweiser is thinking about launching a cable channel called Bud TV. They want to get into the entertainment content business, he said. Would you be interested in filming a special for us? Absolutely, I said. It was the first time I'd ever been asked or approached about doing a comedy special on TV. I was flattered and excited by the prospect. I got my agent and lawyer involved, and the negotiations began. Initially, they wanted to shoot me at a comedy club, but they decided to do it in St. Louis, Budweiser's home base, at the big theater where the company could guarantee a packed house of their employees. They were going to give away free beer to draw a crowd, which was a good idea. There was no way I could bring 1,000 people on the strength of my name alone. At that point, I doubted I could barely draw 80. Ironically, Bud.TV hired the Levity Entertainment Group, LEG, which is now my management production company, to shoot the special. It would be my introduction to the team and people I'd work with closely several years down the road. But for now, They were just the producers of this one show, Hired Guns. In 2005, I was 31 years old, but still wet behind the ears as far as TV style was concerned. I wore a suit because I thought this was what you were supposed to do. In a suit, you were taken seriously. Problem was, I never had the right suit for the right occasion. This suit had a real traveling salesman look. It was black, and I paired it with a cerulean blue button-down shirt and cufflinks. My foot was shoved into a dress shoe that was half the width of my extra-wide Fred Flintstone hooves. The jacket looked like what they would lend you at the hostess stand if you forgot yours. No tailoring. I got it on sale straight off the rack. I call it sale to set. It's not the effect you want for your first time on TV. Bud.TV intended to chop up the hour-long special into 4-minute clips to use as connective tissue between their other programming. After 1 year, ownership of the material would revert back to me, and I could license the special to other networks and keep all the income I generated that way. It seemed like a great deal, and it kind of was. I don't remember which came first, ownership of the special reverting to me or Bud TV shutting down. It only lasted a year, and then Budweiser got out of the entertainment business. Now that I had the rights to the material, and by then a decent manager, we sold it to Comedy Central, a better home for it. In 2008, they aired it several times over the course of a year. Getting my name and face on a popular channel definitely increased my ticket sales, and my gigs got bigger and better. There was no way Comedy Central would have produced the special for me, but since we had it ready to go, they were only too happy to put it on the air. If I hadn't met that Budweiser exec at the Four Seasons and then run into him on the road, it never would have happened. The thing about comedy and success, you never know. When I served him his Budweisers in a frosted glass, I had no idea who he was or what he would do for me one day. He liked me because I treated him well, and I remembered him because he was kind and generous. Random people you meet just might circle back into your life. And if you were an asshole the first time around, they won't be too happy to see you. And they definitely won't offer you a TV special. Flash forward 3 years. By 2011, I had officially signed up with LEG, and Judy Marmel was producing and managing the rollout of my second special called What's Wrong with People. It was filmed in Santa Ana, California, in an old bank that was converted into a theater space with 450 seats. Lana and I were a couple by then, and she had great ideas for the set design, the lighting, and the backdrop. We worked diligently and really thought through the set and the look of the show. We sent detailed notes to the design team, but when we got there, it turned out they ignored most of our directions. We walked in, saw the set, looked at each other and said, "Oh, God, whose special is that going to be?" The stage manager said, yours. Lana definitely doesn't seek out confrontation. But that day, she got so ruffled because this just wasn't our vision. They explained to us that they had to add something to the front of the set for depth or it would have looked bad. Okay, then why didn't they run it by us? Also, the lighting was all these crazy colors, hodgepodge that made no sense to us and had to be fixed ASAP. That day was the first time Lana met my management team. I'd say diplomatically that the LEG people and Lana took careful measure of each other. I preferred the set that Lana and I had chosen, but it wasn't a big deal to me as it was to her. "It's about stand-up," I said. "The audience doesn't give a fuck if the column lighting is gold or purple." However, as I would learn over 10 years of doing these things, the audience might not realize they care about the aesthetics of the set. but the set represents me and adds a vibe or a tone that affects the experience. The look does matter. It could make or break a performance. Lana has since become my creative director, handling everything from set design, wardrobe, and promotional material. So if you like how the stage and the style of the artwork on my tours look, you could thank her for it. I was a bit overweight during that shoot. Despite the warm lighting, I came off as white and clammy, like the room was muggy and stifling. My outfit of tight black jeans, black shoes, brown belt, brown vest, and black shirt were dark, heavy, and unflattering. "What were we thinking?" I asked Lana, and made a mental note to use that phrase as a possible title for a future special. We had picked out the outfit together, but I'd put on 10 pounds since I bought it, and the seams were hanging on for dear life. After seeing the playback, we both cringed. It was a slip-up. What you learn doing TV is that some clothes that look good on a hanger at a dinner table aren't a good match for a stand-up comedy special. The worst part of the outfit was the jeans. People make fun of me to this day about how tight they were. I get comments like, "Nice camel toe." Even friends from home are like, "What the fuck, man? This special was entitled, What's Wrong With People? But they call it, What's Wrong With Your Pants?" In terms of the comedy, I think it's one of my best specials. When I look at it now, I'm distracted, just like the viewers probably were, by the style. I just don't look or feel my best. It didn't occur to me to hit the gym and get in shape as part of the preparation for shooting a TV special. I was worried about getting the comedy right rather than pumping up my abs. I never want to fall into that trap of putting that kind of pressure on myself. And I don't beat myself up about things I can't change in the past. But yeah, the style could have been better. A great C outfit was not the end of the world. I'd do better next time. Because of the A-plus comedy, there would be a next time. I was in great shape when we filmed the Aren't You Embarrassed special in 2014. It was right around the time I got married, and Lana and I had been on a strict diet. We both had blood testing, and I learned I was allergic or highly sensitive to some of my favorite foods like bread, pasta, and scotch, and some random foods like asparagus. For about 6 months, I cut all of them out my diet and I dropped 22 pounds. I didn't change my diet to look good at the wedding. I'd been feeling low energy, sluggish. My wife hadn't been feeling so good either. She was so drained of energy, she could hardly stay awake and focus. Turned out she had a thyroid condition, an actual medical problem. My problem was that I was eating too much bread. The testing did inspire me to go on a health kick, watch what I ate, and work with a trainer again. We shot in my hometown of Chicago, which should have guaranteed a good night, but I didn't particularly like that experience. I made the mistake of using a teleprompter for the first time. Sometimes during a show, I'll forget to do a joke. When you film a special, you don't want to forget anything, because the jokes circle around and come back together at the end. The teleprompter helped me remember the order and to hit every bit, but it also took me out of the moment and interrupted my flow. In just that second of looking down and then glancing up, you could lose the connection with the audience. I'm never as off-the-cuff shooting specials as I am at regular gigs. We filmed 2 shows back-to-back with fresh audiences each time. The show that would air would be the better of the two, with maybe 1 or 2 bits spliced in from the other one. So I had to wear the same exact outfit for both performances. For this show, I went with black jeans and a warm but thin magenta cotton pullover sweater. We were down to the wire choosing the look, and went with the magenta just moments before I walked onto stage. The sweater had one of these elastic bottoms, and every time I moved, and I move a lot in my act, The shirt would creep up and expose the skin of my belly and back. I was continually pulling the sweater back down over my belt. It was a constant but subtle tug of war throughout the filming. My dad was at the taping, and he came back between shows and said, "Your shirt doesn't fit. I could tell from the audience that you kept pulling it down. Nothing gets by this guy." Wardrobe malfunctions are the worst, but I couldn't change now. We shot one of the two versions with the sweater, so I had to put on the clean identical one and wear it. It had to match, just in case we did some editing. I was pissed. "This stupid shirt keeps riding up. It's going to ruin the special," I said to everyone backstage. I liked the look of it, but it was taking me out of the moment. In the back of my head the whole time, I was worried that the shirt would be up to my tits while I was doing a joke. I did like how my hair looked in that one, though. Speaking of hair, when Lana and I first met, my sideburns looked like a cross between Mr. T's and Elvis Presley's. Lana generously waited about a year before sending me to her hair guy. On top of the burns, my hairstyle was like a flat top petrified by copious amounts of hairspray and gel. If you bumped into my head, you'd have to get your outfit dry cleaned. If my hair touched your face, you need a facial. Pre-Lana, I thought this look was sexy. Now I realize it was startling. Pro style tip. For any event, from parties to weddings to comedy specials, do a dress rehearsal and an outfit before you commit to it. Why would you do that was shot in 2016 at the Beacon Theater in New York City. I did 7 sold-out shows there and taped 2 of them. That was a crazy week. My father was there again. My mom stayed in California watching my nieces so my sister and brother-in-law could come too. The Chicago show was cool because it was my hometown, but the New York show was more of a grand event. It sounds cliche, but New York City really does have such an incredible energy. I felt it from the crowd. It fired me up. I think a lot of people in New York gravitate toward my comedy because it's familiar to them. Many first-generation immigrants live in the city. Lots of Italians. I get a great reception, not just in Manhattan, but on Long Island and Brooklyn, down the shore in New Jersey. Anywhere in the Northeast is like I'm back in my own neighborhood. Lana put the outfit together with a stylist friend named Michael Nash. Black pants, a white shirt with a black panel in front, like a penguin or a Kevlar vest. "For the shoes," Michael said, "you might like these." They were black and white like spats. I loved them. The stylist said, "I work for Justin Timberlake on his 2020 tour, and Tom Ford designed these for him for the tour." To be clear, these were not a copy of JT's Tom Ford shoes. These were the shoes that Justin actually wore on his feet while singing and dancing, and probably sweating profusely on his tour. He had 20-odd pairs made. Michael had held on to 2 pairs that weren't trashed. They were my size, so he offered 1 pair to me. I'm not the kind of guy who wears another man's shoes, but I did like the look, and they matched my shirt perfectly. So I searched high and low to find the same pair in retail, but it was impossible. You can't get them. They don't exist anywhere, but with Michael and JT. So I bought Michael a pair of brand new Tom Ford shoes, and he traded them for Justin's hand-me-downs. As soon as I slipped them on, I felt like joining a boy band. They made me feel like dancing. And all week at the Beacon, I was especially agile on my feet. I have a huge problem with sweating on stage, always have, for my whole career. It's grossly evident whenever I perform in a light-colored shirt, something I learned early on not to do. A giant sweat ring does not look good on anyone. I heard that if you get Botox injections in your armpits, you don't sweat as much. So I tried it. Works like a charm, but as I say in my act, I think the sweat has rerouted itself, and now my ass is drenched every time. When you're on stage, there's nowhere to hide. If you look at any physical performer from Richard Pryor to Mick Jagger, these guys are soaked by the end of their shows, like they went through a car wash. For years, I've been on the hunt for a shirt that looks good and doesn't show sweat rings, and I finally found one. It's a polyester spandex blend from Uniqlo, black with a sheen that makes it look wet already. If it gets soaked on stage, you can't even tell. No rings in the pits. No blotches under the tits. I've worn it once in Biloxi, and it didn't creep up at all either. Pro style tip. To hide sweat, go with polyester. It makes you sweat even more, but no one will know. Chapter 8. The Dry Swallow. It was a big week. The biggest in my career so far. And in my sort of humble opinion, I was on top of my game. Just to set the scene, November 2014. My second special for Showtime, Aren't You Embarrassed, was coming out, and I was in New York to do a full week of press for it. I noticed a real shift in how this special was being received compared to my last one. In the almost 2 years since What's Wrong With People came out, I've been touring like an animal all over the world working on my act, especially the physical side of it. I liked how my comedy was evolving, and this new special was the result of all that hard work. I was definitely feeling solid. I would never say super confident, because I come from a family that always thinks negatively, but I was feeling really good. Press week started on Monday with a radio tour. If you don't know what that is, you sit in a room with headphones and a microphone, and a producer patches you into different stations every 5 or 10 minutes to do basically the same interview over and over again, like 80 times. It was a prolonged version of what Vince Vaughn did every morning on the Wild West comedy tour. Like him, I knew how important it was to do the interviews, and I was happy to do them. But after 3 straight days of repeating myself, I was exhausted. I never slipped into autopilot, though. I kept up the energy, and even the sound guy gave me props. So that was in the mornings. In the afternoons, my manager, agent, and I went to meetings, 4 a day, with editors and publishers to pitch this book. More talking, more pimping. It was the first time I'd ever pitched a book idea. And nearly every editor I met got a look on his face or her face that said, "I just don't get this guy." I'd seen that look before, early on in my comedy career. One word? Sandman. So it didn't affect me in the least. I went into every meeting with confidence that someone was going to get it and want to work with me. Most of the editors decided to go in a different direction. I've heard this phrase a lot in my career, too. I always want to preempt it by asking before the meeting or an audition, "What direction are you going to go in so I could follow the map on how to get there?" Some of the editors did like my story. And on the Friday of that week, we accepted an offer from Simon & Schuster. And just like that, a whole new avenue of my career opened up. It was a week of riding high, of everything falling into place. I've been working my ass off for 15 years. No one could ever call me an overnight sensation. And it was all coming together for me. And so many people I cared about were there to share it. My mother, mother-in-law, wife, publicist, and the management team were all there in New York with me. And I fed off their excitement, too. The big week culminated Friday late afternoon with a 5-minute set on Jimmy Fallon. It was my first time doing the Fallon Tonight Show, and the New York studio fascinated me. Right here, Johnny Carson had given so many comedy legends their start. Red Fox, Rodney Dangerfield, Bob Newhart, Don Rickles, George Carlin, Joan Rivers. Walking through the studio, I was looking at the wall of photos of previous guests, taking it all in with awe that I was going to perform on the same stage. For my Fallon premiere, I had to look sharp. Very important to me. Always had been. When I was in high school, I didn't care about being a sports star or getting good grades. I just wanted to be voted best dressed. It's an Italian thing. I chose a 3-piece dark blue Tom Ford suit with a crisp white shirt, no tie, and the watch my wife had given me the day we got married. I was tan with a fresh haircut, had a nice satin finish manicure. I felt like Frank Sinatra. I brought everyone backstage with me and entertained in the dressing room like I was hosting a small party, saying things like, "You guys need any carrots or anything like that?" I was in and out chatting with people in the hall, making introductions, cracking jokes, and having a ball. I remember my mother-in-law walking around backstage talking to different people, from writers to producers. I think she even asked the stage manager if I could get some couch time with Jimmy. A producer came to get me for the walkthrough. I wasn't really paying attention as she led me around the stage. "Okay, the teleprompter's over there," she said. "You'll stand on this mark, you'll wait for Jimmy to join you after the set, etc." In my head, I was thinking, I got my set down cold. I knew what I was going to do. I generally don't like to look at the teleprompter because it takes me out of being in the moment. But I politely listened as she checked off the bullet points and did the sound check. Then I returned to my dressing room to wait for my cue. My wife asked me how I was feeling. I said, "Good. No nerves, no jitters. I had one hell of a week, and I couldn't wait to get out there and cap it off with an appearance on national TV." Finally, they called me to the wings, and Jimmy introduced me. Applause, applause, applause. I walked out on that stage, looked to my right, gave Jimmy a nod, and I got right into it. "Listen, so good to be here. Just ran into Liam Hemsworth backstage. That guy is stunning, all right? So good to be here. Jimmy Fallon, The Tonight Show, New York City. Love New York. A lot of Italians out here. I come from an Italian family, immigrant father. And if you come from immigrant parents, they put you to work real early, okay? I've been working since I've been 8 years old. Watching TV, my father walks into the living room. He's like, 'Hey, go start a business.' Now? The next bit should have rolled off my tongue, but nothing came out. I tried to remember what the next line was, but my brain was completely blank. I couldn't remember anything. I couldn't have told you my wife's name at that moment. I tried to prompt myself by saying, I'm Italian, but after that, nothing. I was literally standing there on the legendary stage, not saying a word, my eyes blinking, as shocked as anyone by this spectacle. The entire place was completely silent. You could hear a pin drop, a grenade pin. I was bombing. I turned to my left and looked at the band. Questlove was staring back at me with a look of fear in his eyes. They all were. I could almost hear them thinking, "This is the guy everybody's been talking about? He can't speak. He's literally losing it on The Tonight Show." So now I remembered the prompter. Look at the prompter. But I didn't know where it was because I didn't pay attention during the walkthrough. I scanned around for it, and I finally found it, but by then, my eyes were blurry. I couldn't make out what the hell it said. I couldn't even read it. I remember thinking, do I need glasses? When the hell did my eyesight get so bad? It occurred to me that I had to start over from the beginning because this was worse than a mid-air collision. My 5 minutes were going by fast, and I had to snap out of this, or they'd be completely gone. I started to look behind me to say to Jimmy, I gotta start over. But as I turned my head, my brain rebooted, and my set popped back in. So after that long, mortifying gap, I picked up where I had left off, saying, "They told me growing up who had what I wanted in the neighborhood." My voice is a bit subdued. The dead silence in the room was replaced with the audience gasp of relief. "He could speak! Thank God!" I kept going. "They didn't buy us anything. We're like, Dad, can we get a dog?" My dad was like, "You want a dog? 3 houses down, they got a dog. You want to pet something with fur? You walk 3 houses down, and then you come back here and cut my grass." The audience started laughing. Maybe it was out of pity, but I didn't care. My mouth was forming the words, and my body was moving. I was doing my set pretty well, But in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, I'm fucked. I just shit the bed on national TV. I'm never coming back here again. It wasn't easy to be funny while mentally planning the funeral for my career. It was not the experience I'd hoped to have on the stage for the first time in front of 200 people in the studio audience and 3.8 million at home. I finished the set and Jimmy came on the stage to announce a commercial break. I got to sit down with him for a minute and said, bro, I'm sorry, I don't know what the hell happened to me out there. I'm just so sorry. Jimmy said, ah, don't worry about it. We could edit it out. No problem. It happens all the time. He was totally nonchalant about it. Oh, okay, I said, but my heart was hammering. I went back to my dressing room and everyone congratulated me and told me how funny it was. How long? I asked. Lana said, oh, that was nothing. How long? 13 seconds. 13 seconds. For 13 seconds, I stood up there as frozen as a wedge of tartufo. Well, my family, my managers, every person in the theater watched in agony, and I thought, did I just get fast-onset Alzheimer's disease? Think of how long 13 seconds actually is. Right now, count it out in your head. Time it on your watch. Imagine talking to a girl at a bar, entertaining her by saying, you want to dance with me? And then suddenly falling silent with your mouth flapping open for a full 13 seconds while she stares at you, waiting for you to say something. By the time your brain rejoined reality, she'd be gone. I've run into trouble on stage before, falling out of my set and being unable to remember how to pick it back up. So that wasn't the first time I experienced the comedian's worst nightmare. But when you're on stage at a comedy club and you freeze, you could always go into the audience, pick out someone in the front row and say, where are you from? It's a stalling technique, but it works. You take a minute to collect yourself, and a line or bit will surface that you could grab onto like a life preserver. Grasping in a vast blankness of the mind doesn't happen to me too often. Knocking on wood, spinning in the evil eye, but there are triggers. If someone in the first rows started looking at their phone, I immediately think they're not paying attention. They're not interested in what's going on up here. I'm not so insecure and sensitive that I need every single audience member to be riveted by every jewel that drips out of my mouth. But when someone's scrolling through their Instagram while I'm in the middle of a performance, it's a distraction. The phone light goes on, the person's face starts glowing. It's just as annoying to the people in the seats around them. I can't help but be knocked out of my act. So what I do is I address the phone user, especially early on in the set. I understand people are going to have to look down for a second now and then. Maybe they got a babysitter, they're checking for emergency texts. I use a stock joke and say, hey, what are you look? Is it the babysitter? Isn't it the reason you got a babysitter? Are you babysitting them? And then I go, when I grew up, my parents left the house. They didn't come back for 3 days. It's a way to address the problem, let them know I don't like it, and keep the show rolling. If I have to call someone out, I do it in a nice way, unless someone is not nice back, and then the gloves come off. The audience is there to relax and have a good time. If you come back at someone hard, the audience tightens up. They feel like they have to behave and be proper. The opposite vibe from what you want in a comedy club. When you're taping for TV and get stuck, however, you can't go to the audience. You can't even go to the camera guy and say, nice shirt. Did your mom pick that out for you? The camera, which is so big, a guy rides in it, is right in front of you. And the audience is about a mile away, it seems, and obscured by lights. Plus, the format of TV taping is pretty rigid. You hit your mark, you do your set, and if there's time and the host likes you, you sit on the couch and banter for a minute. In fact, most likely, your 5-minute set is pre-approved. You have to write it out word for word and hand it in. They make it very clear that you're not supposed to stray from the material you said you were going to do. Before what is known in my house as the night I shit the bed on Fallon, as in, hey babe, what hotel we were staying at the night I shit the bed on Fallon? Oh, the London. Right, thanks. I'd done plenty of TV. I knew exactly what to expect and what to do. But my years of experience evaporated during those 13 seconds. It was like I was 25 again, back at Highland Grounds. Comedians work their whole lives for a shot on The Tonight Show. In the early days of stand-up, it was the venue, and the one place that could launch a career into the stratosphere. Nowadays, comedians have options, but there's still a reverence associated with this stage. Only the best of the best get there. The stakes were sky-high for me to kill, and I blew it. I honestly thought my career was over, that those 13 seconds would be the number one viral video on YouTube the next day. Comedian shits the bed, whole house on Fallon. Comedian literally dies up there on The Tonight Show. Comedian keeps repeating, "I'm Italian," on Fallon. Duh, we know. You might think I was overreacting. You don't think 13 seconds of horrible could destroy a decades-long career? Look, I was sinking in quicksand for 13 seconds, convinced I was going to drown. If I had the power of perspective, I would have told myself, "Sebastian, you're going to be okay. You'll laugh it off, and it'll be fine." During the interminable silent gap, though, for the rest of the set and for the remainder of the evening, all I could think about was, "It's over. I'm fucked. Thank God my father isn't here." After the taping, we went out to Ossetra Marini on Lafayette Street in Soho, a northern Italian-style restaurant recommended by my manager, Chris Mazzilli, a man who can name and rate 100 Italian restaurants in New York off the top of his head. I've been looking forward to this meal and had spent an hour on the website poring over the menu, drooling. The dinner was supposed to be the cherry on top, the big celebration of the week of triumphs, the special, the tour, the book deal, and Fallon. I was a wreck. I sat down at the table. It was a nice place, rustic, with long farm tables. I'd love to go back there under more pleasant circumstances, but it was all I could do not to get up and leave the restaurant. I'm emotional, a crier, a man who lets it all out in front of people. Quivering chin, ugly cry face. I love to marinate in my own tears. I held them in at that dinner, mainly because I was still in shock. Everybody was talking about what to order. The handmade tagliatelle with bolognese ragu, the cappelletti with truffles, some ricotta, prosciutto, the rack of lamb with arugula anchovy pesto, the 40-day dry-aged tomahawk ribeye. I'm getting hungry saying the menu now, but at the time, my appetite was gone. "You think it went okay?" I kept asking. "It's going to look like shit, probably." Lana said, "Just forget it. It's over. We're at this amazing restaurant. Have some mortadella and relax. There's nothing you could do." For the first time in my life, mortadella did not make me happy. "Eat, Sebastian," said my ma. "I'm not hungry," I said. The whole table stopped and looked at me. For me to refuse food? This was serious. My mom probably thought about calling 911. I'm always starving after a performance. But at Osteria Marini, I couldn't eat one bite. I tried to rally my spirits, but how could I enjoy myself? I didn't know what the edit was going to look like, and it was going to air later that evening. I couldn't relax until I saw it. Were 3.8 million people going to point at their screens and say, "Look at this idiot"? It was too much to contemplate, yet I couldn't stop thinking about it. My family and friends reassured me at dinner. They described the reactions to my brain freeze while they watched it live in the green room. My wife said we all looked blankly at one another, holding our breath. "More tongue-tied than you." My manager Chris, owner of Gotham Comedy Club, had seen hundreds bomb on stage. He said I kept saying, "Oh my God, oh my God," over and over. So yeah, it was bad. My mother-in-law said, "Your suit looked beautiful." Mom said, "I've never seen you like that before. It was suspenseful?" They were trying to crack me up, and I pretended to go along with it. I choked down some pasta, but every bite was a dry swallow. Lana and I went back to our hotel room at the London. It was already turned down, and I love turned down service. There is something about leaving your room a mess and coming back at the end of the night with a little treat on your pillow and a bottle of water on the nightstand. It's always an added bonus when they leave a card with the temperature for the following day. This is the first time the turndown service didn't make me happy. I was too anxious to lie down. I had to see the Frankenstein hack job of my set before I could hope to relax. Lana was having none of it. She kept insisting it would be fine. But how could she know? We had to wait and see. Finally, at 11:30 p.m., 5 hours since the taping, the show started. I barely heard Fallon's intro. Liam Hemsworth came on, and Lana said, "He really is stunning." "I know, right?" And then it was my turn. I got through the first 45 seconds of my act with confidence and swagger. There was a quick cutaway to a different camera angle that picked me up as soon as my brain started working again. If you check it out on YouTube, viewed 1.6 million times, 1.5 by me, right at 46 seconds, it looks like I'm coming out of a coma. My voice shaky, my eyes look dazed or haunted, but I did recover. And after a rocky 5 or 10 seconds, I got back into the rhythm of my set and made it through. Jimmy joined me on stage to shake my hand, all smiles and upbeat. I looked hollowed out. I gave him a traumatized glance, but he started jumping around, mimicking my moves, and I followed suit. He did exactly the right thing to bring the energy up. Easy for him. He knew my gap would be edited out, but I didn't. I turned to Lana and said, "Not a disaster." "Not even close," she said, smiling. "Are you okay now?" "Actually, to tell you the truth, I'm starving." Now that the 100-pound anvil of dread was gone, my stomach was desperately empty. I ordered the Branzino. When the room service brought it up, the guy looked at me and said, "Be careful. There may be still a few bones. I don't want you to choke." I said, "Great. I already choked once tonight." We live in a world where everybody is always talking about how fantastic his or her life is. Vacation photos, toasting on a boat with champagne, celebrations, achievements. And that's what people put on social media. Everybody's just bragging all the time. Or humble bragging, which is even worse. It's like nobody ever fucks up or does anything wrong. But people do fuck up in life all the time. We make mistakes, big and small. We all have stories to tell about the not-so-good times, and I happen to believe that those are the ones that we should share. It would be like a public service so everyone doesn't think being perfect is the norm. If you pretend nothing's wrong, then you don't take the step of asking, "What the hell happened?" Since my career and my family's security relies on me not shitting the bed, I don't know, the whole house, the fucking entire neighborhood on TV, I needed to know what caused my brain to betray me that night and take measures so that never occurred again. I think what happened was a deadly combo of overload and overconfidence. The overload was all the craziness that week. There was so much going on. I was talking on the radio tours. I was pitching the book. I was doing other interviews about the special. I had people in town. I felt responsible for entertaining them. My head was spinning in a bunch of different directions, and by the time I stepped onto that stage, it had spun clear off my neck. The overconfidence was thinking I could handle doing everything at once. No problem. I thought I could just go up there and do stand-up as if it was no big deal. It was like saying a smug, "I got this," while falling off a bridge. I didn't respect the mental demands of doing a live comedy set on national TV. It was almost like after a week of glutting my ego with positive feedback, I forgot the philosophy of life that had gotten me this far. Stay hungry. Pare it down. Keep focused on what you're doing and on the reasons you're doing it. I would never again be too casual about any performance, anywhere. Since Fallon, I reset my pre-show routine. If I have people in the dressing room, I kick them out 10 minutes before I go on stage. Or they could sit there in stone silence while I review video of previous gigs and collect my thoughts. I get in my own space rather than inviting others into it. Afterwards, we can talk and laugh and, most likely, eat. But before I go on, no talk, no food, clear head, no distractions. 1 month after the Fallon disaster, I did Conan. Back on the horse that bit me on the ass. I kept thinking about the yips, a phenomenon when a pitcher suddenly can't control the ball. He's throwing it, doing his regular motion, and then the ball goes wild. No matter how he adjusts, he can't fix it. It's totally mental. I got it in my head that the yips could happen to me. I thought, shit, will I freeze every time I go on TV? Is this going to be the new awful norm? To ward off the yips, I took the concept of staying hungry to the extreme. It was like I was training for a marathon. The whole week leading up into Conan, I ran my set in the bathroom. I ran it in the shower. I ran it with my wife. The day of the taping, I had Lana and one of my managers with me. You better believe I paid attention to the walkthrough this time. I could do a full two-scale rendering of the stage and the teleprompter location from memory that day. Complete change of wardrobe. I wore a thin black cashmere sweater and black jeans, black shoes. Television studios are kept icy cold, and it was December. Still, I was sweating. We were in the dressing room, and it was getting close. I told my wife, get out. I gotta be alone. She got up to leave. I said, get back in here and let me do the set in front of you. She came back in. I said, no, leave. I was driving her nuts. And then the moment of truth. I was called to the stage. I'm dealing with a possum problem in the house. Just moved into a new house. Me and my wife like to go in the yard at night, maybe have a little wine. And these possums are comfortable. Like, if they could talk, they'd be like, what the hell are you doing here? Now, I grew up in an immigrant family. And how we handled possums, raccoons, my father would be like, we're gonna murder these bastards. We're gonna pour antifreeze on bologna. What? That was the 45-second mark. The point on Fallon when it all went to hell. On the video of this performance, my eyes are clear. I am totally present and in the moment. I look up with a huge smile on my face because I remembered everything. The next line was right there, and I punched it. I woke up in the morning, birds, squirrels, raccoons, just murdered all over the property. Neighbors coming by, have you seen my cat? Nah, we haven't seen it. Check the yard. I killed on Conan. And I proved to myself that I wasn't cursed with the yips. I'd redeem myself and gain perspective on what could happen when you get too comfortable, too confident. Redemption is a theme in my life. The drive to correct mistakes and rectify wrongs. Lana knew what it meant to me to walk off Conan's stage in one piece, and she gave me a big hug in the dressing room. No tears. By the end of the night, my face hurt from smiling so hard. She said, how do you feel now? My wife is like a shrink, always asking me how I feel. Hungry, I said. Where you want to eat? Chapter 9. Icing on the Cake. The American Comedy Awards are the most important awards that you never heard of, at least to us comedians. I wouldn't call them the Oscars or the Emmys of comedy, though. The Oscars do, rarely, award prizes to comedic films, and the Emmys give a nice showcase for funny TV shows and performers. But the Lucys, as the ACA statue was called, after Lucille Ball, were a very big deal, especially for the winners. When I was nominated in 2014 for Best Club Comic, I was in shock. The other nominees, Maria Bamford, Bill Burr, my old neighbor, Gerard Carmichael, Ron Funches, Kyle Kinane, Sean Patton, Brian Regan, Rory Scovel, and Doug Stanhope are all top-tier people I admire, especially Brian Regan. My introduction to Brian's comedy was in 1988 at a Thanksgiving dinner watching him on TV. He had a bit about getting a snow cone after a Little League baseball game. The way he told the story, his distinctive delivery, and how he acted it out is what made it so funny. It can't be translated into words. Google Brian Regan, Little League. Brian's ability to convey his message through his body and vocal inflections adds a dimension to his comedy. In 2016, I got to see it up close while working with him at the Oddball Comedy Festival. He's the type of act that you could see over and over again. You laugh just as hard the 10th time you hear the material as you did the first time. He's the type of comedian other comedians backstage gather around the monitors to watch. I've heard he takes a shot of peach schnapps, the too sweet pink liqueur in Sex on the Beach, the bikini martini, and the fuzzy navel, before every show. On the Oddball tour, I joined him in this ritual for shits and giggles. All of the other nominees in my category were entrenched in the comedy world. I was never really a member of that club, nor had I ever participated in popularity contests. I always kept an eye on who got nominated for such awards, though, and wondered who the hell was in charge of choosing the list. When I heard the news, I called my managers, figuring there was some sort of mistake, but they confirmed the nomination was real. I was up for a Lucy, and I was invited to an award ceremony at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York a few weeks later. The event organizers weren't providing air travel or hotel reservations, but they were serving a barely edible meal and free drinks. If I didn't attend and actually won, the presenter would have to say, "Sebastian Maniscalco isn't here tonight because he tried on his wedding tuxedo and couldn't button it, and didn't have time to get the waist let out. I'll accept the award for him." On the off chance the presenter was going to say my name, I wanted to be there to hear it. Did I feel a need to be in the room, to look pleasantly surprised, kiss my wife, stand up, pretend to trip dashingly as I wove my way through the maze of tables to accept my award, and deliver a speech that would be a bonanza of laughter and tears? No. I never did comedy for awards, but it's nice to be recognized, to get a kind of like milestone marker in your career. I think all performers have fantasized about what they would say at the podium. If for nothing else, then because it would be nice to thank those who helped me along the way. First order of business, my outfit. Since NBC was televising the awards in prime time, another reason to be there, I decided on my Tom Ford wedding tux. True to form, it didn't fit anymore. Last time I wore the pants was around 2 years prior, and I had been 16 pounds lighter. When I managed to close them, the button and buttonhole were hanging on to one another for dear life. If I wore them like that, they might have left a permanent line on my belly, like I had a C-section. I tried buttoning the jacket and wearing the vest, but who was I kidding? The muffin top at this point was more like a popover. I wore the tux anyway. Even tight, it was my best option. I wrote an acceptance speech. I practiced it in our hotel room at the London the night of the award show. Lana was taking forever to get ready. It was a special night, so I didn't want to rush her and get into an argument. I took a deep breath in an attempt to find a friendly voice and asked, "Babe, you almost ready?" "One second," she replied from the bathroom. 20 minutes later, she emerged. She was worth the wait. She looked stunning in a tangerine Dior dress with spaghetti straps and a peak of pink lining at the handkerchief hem. "Do you like these earrings or the other ones?" she asked. Any answer I gave her would be the one that got us out the door faster. Hence, "The ones you have on are perfect." We hopped into an Uber just as the downpour started. On the way, I asked Lana to close my shirt buttons. I didn't ask her earlier because it would have taken up even more time. So she went to do them, but there was a problem. They weren't going in the holes. I'd never seen this type of button before. You needed an engineering degree to figure them out, and I only had a corporate organizational communications degree. I was sweating, digging my chin into my collarbone to see, and twisting my torso like I was in Cirque du Soleil. Lana tried to get them in while I sucked in my popover to make sure my pants button didn't fly off and shatter a window. In a fit of frustration, I called my guy Jason at Tom Ford. Lana had the number, and I said, man, my shirt is screwed up. I can't get the fucking buttons in. He walked us through it, and we finally got them in.